Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, a show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Villanueva, and alongside me, as always, is not the 16th, not the 17th, or the 18th, but the one and only Mr. Spencer Williams.
What a nice thing to say. Thanks, Eddie.
And speaking of copycats all day, every day, we got with us intern red shirt, hopefully maybe moving up the totem pole, Amy.
What the heck?
If you have no clue what we're talking about or you didn't read the title, we are talking about the recently dropped film for 2025, and that is Bong Joon-ho's Mickey 17. So stick around as we dive into that, give you our thoughts, give you our ideas, and give you kind of our understanding of what this movie's trying to say. But before we do, Spencer, give us them opening credits.
Tune in to brand new episodes each and every week.
Mostly weeks, yeah.
Wow, mostly weeks?
I mean, sometimes you get
they're
extra
every
happy,
week.
But you've also they're sometimes every week. Extra happy and done two in 1 week. But
gee,
week.
If only we had an intern who could help me with all that. Anyway, go ahead.
I'm sorry, that's no longer me.
On all your favorite streaming platforms and over on our website at filmlosophers.com. Also, connect with us on the social pages at facebook.com/filmlosophers and on Twitter, Instagram, and Threads at filmlosophy101. And there's also a blue sky at filmlosophers podcast.
That's right. Head on over to our website at filmlosophers podcast. There we got allegedly over 300 episodes, everything from action, anime, comedy, suspense, thrills, and chills. If you're looking for it, we got it. Head on over to our website at filmlosophers podcast.com. You can also check us out over wherever they're streaming out on the streaming shows, whether it's iTunes, Libsyn, Player FM, Audio Boom, Spotify, Pandora, TuneIn, iHeart, Libsyn, I just went in a circle, and Amazon Music. Tune into your heart's desire on any one of those platforms. Look for us there at The Filmlosophers. Give us a follow or subscribe and listen in. Tell us what you think. Give us your thoughts on the movie and give us your thoughts on what we're talking about. And of course, if you like what you hear, give us a 5-star review. We've earned it.
You have.
Yes, please.
What?
Yes, please. Even for that pause.
Okay. Yeah. And yeah. We'll give you the social links at the end of the episode. We are back with another great episode to talk about a sci-fi film that really is unique in every situation and in every way that we can talk about it. But of course, we are trying some new things. And so I kind of wanted to, last week we did a really fun segment with our conspiracy theory during the conversation stage of our show, yes, where usually we try to fill it with something fun. So this week I wanted to do something fun again. And okay. I haven't told either of these two what we're
it's
doing.
It's not in the outline, guys. We don't know what's coming.
There's literally a word that says conversation and there's nothing here.
Yep. So I wanted to kind of see where your guys' brains were at. So we're going to
what?
Do a trivia show of testing your sci-fi knowledge.
Hey,
you're going to be good.
Maybe. Or it's going to fail spectacular.
This listing is going to give us an opportunity to kind of see where everybody's head's at. Ultimately, your guys', both you and Amy. I wanted to see where your guys' head was at in terms of your knowledge of sci-fi and how qualified you are to have this conversation.
There's a reason that I was an intern for so long.
If this starts talking about 70s sci-fi, I'm going to be
we're
lost.
We're so out. I mean, I got a little bit, but not enough.
Yeah, me too. I don't know what happened in 70s Battlestar Galactica.
So we're going to go over. So here are the rules of the game. We're going to be going over 10 trivia questions. Uh-oh. I need you guys, so we don't, there's no buzzers here at the table.
There could have been.
There could have been, but I wanted it to be more fun. I want you guys to give a unique sound that is uniquely yours to act as the buzzer.
Got it.
So you could either.
Got it.
Okay, you guys have your own unique sound?
If they sound the same, though, we're gonna have a problem.
Yeah. So again, we have a list of 10 questions. Obviously, the person who ends up with the most amount of right answers wins the game.
Spencer.
And will ultimately be the reigning champion for the next time we do this. So they'll be pitting up against whoever else throws their hat in the ring for that. So between our interns, between our junior filmlosophers, between the hosts of the show.
Or guests.
This will be something that we'll be doing. All right, here we go. First question. And the main rule that I do have is please, so make sure the question is fully stated, number one.
And this isn't Jeopardy rules where you just stop dead wherever you are.
No, as soon as I say the last word of this of a question, make your noise.
Okay, you but you're not going to put an obnoxious pause where it's like, what was the name of this character 30 years ago?
No.
Thank you. That was a very good point.
That's ridiculous. No, I won't do that. I'm going to read the question fully once and that's it. So as soon as you make your noise, you're going to get called on. If you get the answer wrong, you don't get a second chance. It moves over to the other person to take it.
Okay.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So you can't say, oh, it was Darth Vader. Wait, no, it was actually, no, you don't get that. Once you say your first answer.
Pause and then go with it.
That's
it's, in other words.
All right, trying to figure out how to break this game.
Now I have another.
We can break it.
I'm sorry, you can't add in rules. You just finished the rule section.
I never said I was done.
This is exactly why I asked about the pauses.
And then the third question is you have 5 seconds to answer.
Five?
Yeah.
What if I need to take a break? Can I get eight?
No, 5 seconds. All right.
Here we go. Say that.
Question one. Oh, I wonder if I have...
No.
You really should have...
This is why we don't know what's coming. Because we're having fun. We're having fun.
We are having fun.
Mandatory fun.
Yes.
Mandatory fun.
You will be here for fun and have happy.
And have happy.
All right. Here we go. The first question is, what is Ripley's first name in Alien? Spencer.
Yours did sound like mine. I'm glad I didn't do it.
Oh. Spencer.
Ellen.
There you go.
Yay.
Point for Spencer.
Yay. Because I was about to do the same sound, so I'm so glad I did it.
Question two. In the TV series Stranger Things, what is the name of the parallel dimension? Amy.
The Upside Down.
The Upside Down is correct. Good job. I'm not... I mean, I...
You have chosen wise.
Yay!
You need to put more right answers.
It's either going to be that or...
He chose poor.
I mean, all right, so we're tied neck and neck, 1-1. What's up?
Oh, I just wanted to make sure that other people can hear the soundboard. I mean, playback.
Oh, yeah, I have it up. I mean...
Okay.
Okay, so here we go.
Good job.
Question three. Now we're getting into the thick of it.
Uh-huh.
What simulation is Kirk accused of cheating at in the 2009 remake of Star Trek? That was Spencer.
I'll give it to Spencer. This is all his house anyway.
That is the Kobayashi Maru.
Yeah.
Say it again.
The Kobayashi Maru.
The pronunciation is a little off.
No, it is not.
No, yeah, I mean, I would give him the Kobayashi Maru.
That's more accurate. It's Kobayashi, not Kobayashi.
No, you do not give this away for not being able to pronounce Japanese. My bad for you guys being competitive.
You know what?
Hey, I know.
Okay.
Star Trek guy. Don't mess.
All right. Okay.
Also,
we'll give that.
Too.
We'll give that to Spencer.
Good job on you for knowing that.
Yeah.
Also, we went at the same time with our sounds.
All right, question four. So right now it's 2-1 with Spencer in the lead. Question four. The movie Minority Report is based on a story written by what sci-fi writer? Amy.
Philip K. Dick.
Hey, good job. We just wanted to give you that.
Yeah, no one can see me dancing. It's okay.
All right, now it's 2-2. We are at the midway point of the question. So question five. What is the primary power source for the DeLorean time machine in Back to the Future?
Ah,
which one?
Spencer.
Exactly.
The primary power is plutonium.
You got a button?
Man, where'd it go? There we go.
He chose one.
Nope.
Because it's a miss.
All right.
Because it
Amy,
depends on the Mr. Fusion.
One. Two.
You
three,
already said it.
Yeah.
Four. Oh.
He chose poorly.
Yeah, because you've got the Mr. Fusion later on.
The
primary power source
for the DeLorean time machine is the flux capacitor.
No, that's not a power source.
What makes it go is a power source.
Yeah.
Well, then this question's incorrect. So I guess
it's either the Mr. Fusion or the reactor. Because he got the conversion in 2015.
Yeah. Oh, Spencer, I like your brain.
All right, we'll move forward then.
Yeah. Our nerd is showing.
It is still 2-2 on question 6, because question 5 is irrelevant. Question 6. Which sci-fi film franchise features the Weyland-Yutani Corporation? Amy.
Alien.
That is correct. Oh, lost my...
You don't have a button. Just say, good job. That's a good one.
All right. So Amy is winning 3-2. The next question is, we might have given it away already. What year does Marty McFly travel to in Back to the Future Part 2? Yes, Spencer.
2015.
There we go. Yeah.
That was the correct Back to the Future question.
That's what happens when you have nerds in the thing and they're going to just give you too much information.
That's what I was like, which one?
All right. It is now 3-3. The next question we have is, who played a younger version of Tommy Lee Jones in Men in Black 3? Amy.
That would be one Josh Brolin.
Josh Brolin is correct.
Because I like Men in Black 3. That's the good one.
Okay.
It is.
Let's see. What star of TV's Firefly did the voice of the motion capture for the robot Sonny in iRobot? Amy.
That would be one Alan Tudyk.
That is correct.
I always forget his name because like the second he said it, I was like, I know his face. I forgot his name.
I was waiting for you to say his name in Firefly. I would have given you that.
So we're at 5-3, I believe.
Yeah.
I don't
know how many questions we've done. There's one that doesn't count.
Yeah, which is why, and I only have one more left. So, well, technically I have two left. So,
That's
right.
Not mathin'.
No, it's not. That's 11. How's that work?
That would be 11 instead of 10.
What?
Your math not mathin'.
No, I'm adding one.
Oh,
okay.
Because I have to replace the one that didn't work out.
Replacement. Gotcha.
All right.
All right. This question needs to be answered in full. So, in the second Star Trek film, what is the full name of the iconic villain played by Ricardo Montalban? Spencer.
Yeah.
I believe it is Khan Noonien Singh.
Hey!
I was going to go, which one is the two?
I didn't hit the button and it didn't go off. So good job.
Get all the clapping.
So we are at 4-5 and we have one more question for this. Mm-hmm. So this is for either Amy to take the lead or for Spencer to tie it up.
Let's go tie.
Let's go tie. Whoop, whoop.
So the question is, what year does the movie Blade Runner take place?
I'm going to see if I get it.
Amy.
I almost said 2049.
I was going to guess because I don't know.
It's 2000. No, so I'm so like 2049 was my guess and it's wrong.
That is extremely wrong because that's
the
sequel.
Second one was 2049. Yeah. And that was a Blade Runner. No, I'm technically correct in my own head.
Oh, there we go. Spencer, you want to take a stab at it?
Oh, let's go with 2029. Subtract 20 years.
Yeah, 2020? No.
2019.
Even if it was 2015.
Oddly enough, actually, it was 2019.
Dang it! Yeah.
We're on the
10 years off.
We're on the 9 train, though. We got that much.
All right, so I need to come up with another one.
Because
it was
because a red shirt, quote unquote, can't win.
What?
I didn't say that.
He's been labeling me as a red shirt. Spencer.
Wow. Okay, this one's for the last one since you guys kind of nullified that last question.
Uh-huh.
So
nobody had an answer that was acceptable.
The 1960 movie.
That's close to the 70s, I already said. Just so we're clear.
Let's hear him out. Let's hear him out.
The 1960 movie, The Time Machine, is based on a book by which author?
Oh, wow.
Spencer.
It's H.G. Wells.
Hey, tied it up. There we go. Oh, wait. Hold on. Hold on. There we go. There we go.
Yeah, there we're both great.
Yeah. We each got a book question, too. Yeah. Look at that. Spread across everything evenly.
All right.
Fun fact about the 60s version of The Time Machine. We watched that in English class. Mm-hmm. And this was during the seventh grade. And at a certain point, the English teacher was like, oh, this movie's too scary. And then turned it off and we didn't get to see the end.
Really?
No. Yeah.
So you're just like, hello, Morlocks.
I know. That was it.
This is like that Friends episode where like they turn, she, what's her name, talks about how that her mom always turned off Old Yeller before it got to the end. And then, and so,
Phoebe?
Yeah, no, is it Phoebe? I think it's Phoebe. Whoever is Lisa Kudrow's character.
Yes, Phoebe.
And she's like, what are you guys watching? Oh, Old Yeller. And they're like, why are you crying? Like, oh, have you not seen? Like, oh, yeah, I always just watched. But mom would always turn it off before it ended because they just, they all lived happily ever after. And then that showed the ending and Phoebe like losing her. What kind of doggy snuff film is this? But like, I can imagine Spencer in his class and the teacher's like, and the Morlocks and the people just lived happily ever after together. And they were just the best of friends. And
no, I had to wait till the 2000s Time Machine came out.
Yeah, yeah. Guy ending. Oh, Guy Pearce and what's his name?
Mos Def.
Mos Def. No, what is wrong with you?
My brain went to an entirely different one that was from the 90s as well, but that was Hitchhiker's Guide. That was early 2000s. My bad.
Did you say Mos Def?
Yeah.
I could not see Mos Def in that role.
That would be
at
so
all.
Fun, though.
You mean Orlando Jones?
Yeah, that's right.
Oh, there you go. And no, totally two different people. Oh, my gosh.
Course, yeah, 100% different.
I was thinking Hitchhiker's Guide.
And then, of course, the illustrious Jeremy Irons as the leader of the Morlocks. In the most hideous of makeups. But, I mean, if you were going to have anybody play that role, it would be Jeremy. Okay, back to the questions. Okay.
Wait, so I thought we were done.
That tied it up, didn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, we need a tiebreaker.
What?
That's not what you said.
100%.
I said either Amy was going to run away with it and win, or you're going to tie it up.
And we tied it up. And we're okay with that.
So we need a tiebreaker.
What?
Why?
What is wrong with you people?
Sometimes in life, Eddie, there are no winners. There are no losers. There just are people.
Also, we need to celebrate each other.
Yeah.
Last question. And this is for all the marbles.
Okay.
We don't have marbles to give.
And I hope you're ready.
How did Mickey 16 die?
Spoiler alert. No.
That is a good spoiler alert, though.
All right. Final question. Who directed the 80s sci-fi classic Total Recall? This is where I need the Jeopardy theme song. I'm surprised I didn't put it on here.
All I've got is 2 weeks.
To that one very particular character that has 3 advantages. Oh my god.
Here, we'll play this as a means to just waiting for you guys.
What does that even mean?
Oh, here, how about this? Hey, you guys got, anybody got an answer?
I can say a director.
Knock yourself out.
Let's see. It's not Steven Spielberg, so I'm going to go with Steven Sondheim.
That's not even a director. Ames, yeah, but I don't even have to dignify that with a response.
I like the jazz music then.
No.
I know it's based on a Philip K. Dick book. That's the only thing I can help you with.
No,
it's a Paul, maybe? No, I want to say it's Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Hold on. I want to go back to Steven Sondheim making this
R.I.P. baby
musical movie, Total Recall. She has 3 boobs. Or no, 1 boob. Wait, no, she had 3.
She had three, yeah.
She didn't like,
have
1. No, so the woman who has 1 is the one from Kung Pao.
Into
the Fist. But this one, yeah, she had 3. So... yeah, that'd be very interesting to have. What's his name? Who's the one from Dear Evan Hansen?
What is his?
Ben,
what is your last name?
Platt. Oh,
yes, Benjamin Platt. Good job, Spencer.
Yeah, I can imagine him singing.
That
he's going to play the Arnold Schwarzenegger character in this one. You know, just,
that would make sense.
Yeah.
Just going.
All right.
Waving through the window has a different meaning in this whole movie.
waving through three windows. All right, well, we'll leave it at a stalemate here with a tie of 5-5. The answer was Paul Verhoeven. So
again, I'm like, it's a Philip K. Dick. It's based on a Philip K. Dick book. Like, there's a lot of them that are. So I'm like, yay.
Most sci-fi is. So, but yeah, that was a little bit of fun to add to our interesting sci-fi knowledge exposition. But this does transition us over into our review of the evening, and that is our take on the recently dropped Bong Joon-ho film Mickey 17. So this movie has been talked about all year last year, and actually Spencer was the one who turned us on to this film and mentioning that it was on the horizon. So we eagerly put it on the schedule, and as soon as the trailer started coming out, we were absolutely stoked to go and check it out. So, Spencer, before we continue forward, why don't you give us that official synopsis goodness?
The unlikely hero Mickey Barnes has found himself in the extraordinary circumstances of working for an employer who demands the ultimate commitment to their job, to die for a living. With one regeneration, however, things go very wrong.
Written, produced, and directed by Bong Joon-ho, and based on the 2022 novel Mickey 7 by Edward Ashton, the film stars Robert Pattinson in the title role, alongside Naomi Aki, Steven Yeun, Toni Collette, and Mark Ruffalo. A couple key pieces of information about the film. Bong Joon-ho's first film after the Oscar-winning Parasite back in 2019. The novel that was adapted, Mickey 7, was released in February of 2022. Its sequel novel, there actually is already a sequel to the first novel, was released just over a year later in March of 2023. And it's interesting, the differences between the two books, between the book and the movie, as far as like the direction for the story arc and a couple key pieces, but the overall message and the imagery are the same. So, and we'll talk about that in a second. Another key piece of information, while it's well known that Pattinson plays multiple versions of Mickey due to the cloning process, what many don't realize is that director Bong Joon-ho insisted on filming certain key scenes without Pattinson knowing which version of Mickey he was playing until just before shooting. This method was meant to capture the confusion and existential dread of a clone struggling with his own identity, leading to some of the film's most unsettling and raw performances. It's true, because this is very much, you don't realize the subtle differences of it until after the fact that you're, you know, reflecting back on every single clone and so forth. So, and in a last bit of information that I thought was really interesting, in a blink and you miss it moment, one of the digital monitors inside the cloning facility briefly flashes a cryptic phrase, Mickey 1 was never found. Fans have speculated that this could hint at a darker backstory. Was the first Mickey truly lost, or was something more sinister at play? Bong Joon-ho is known for layering his films with hidden meanings, so this could be a subtle clue to a deeper mystery within the Mickey 17 universe. I thought that was really fun to kind of throw in there because of the fact that if you've seen any of Bong Joon-ho's films, he loves to create mystery and intrigue around the universe that he builds. And the subtle insistencies that he puts in here of like, oh, this is included here for a bigger implication or whatnot, is something that runs rampant throughout most of his films, especially when you look at his more recent films like with Snowpiercer and Parasite as well. So we all got a chance to see this movie, and needless to say, this was a unique experience within film watching, because it's not very often that you see a movie and say, you know, this was not a direction I thought I would ever see of a movie like this, or the story be written in a certain way. You know, obviously it's based on a novel, so there is some, you know, source material, but overall the direction of the film was very unique. So sorry, I thought you were going to say something.
No, I was agreeing with you. Oh, and the fact also, I believe this was written and it started, did it start shooting? I know it was written before the original Mickey 7 book came out. It was based on like rough drafts and what he had read originally before the final publication.
That's actually a really good question, but I don't really know.
I don't know either. I just remember reading that and I was like, oh, so you had some ideas from something somebody was working on and you turned it into something else, which makes me kind of excited because I'm like, oh, that's like a great place to just have a little stepping stone and go doo-doo.
Yeah. Not to mention, like, if you're looking at something that is so recent, like you take a look at adaptations like we've seen with comic book movies and so forth. Obviously, there's a little bit of time for a fan base to be built around it and for people to have their own kind of fantasy, you know, mental image played out for how the scene would go if it was adapted into some form of visual media like TV or movies. And so with something like this, it is so visually driven, the novel itself, that I don't think there was enough time for anyone else to really grab at the idea of it and visually see it in their own mind. So this, for the director to take that immediately from there and begin to build out what the universe looks like through his eyes, it's a pretty big jump and it's a pretty big risk, honestly. But, you know, if there's anybody who has the capability of doing something like that, it's this director, you know. We are going to do mild spoilers. I don't want to give away too much because this film just recently came out and I would love for people to get a chance to check it out and give us their own thoughts. So if you are planning to see the film, just know that in the conversations we will have, slight spoiler alert.
Slight.
So let's talk about expectations. Now, I want to first kind of hit Spencer with this because I think, Spencer, you've been the one who's been the biggest proponent for this film and have been excited the most out of all of us. Not to say that we haven't been excited on our parts, you know, Amy and I, but you were the one who brought this film to the table as far as putting on the schedule. And what were some of your expectations for it?
You know, this is one of those ones where sometimes I just like to be very surprised by what I see. And with this one, I originally saw the poster on the side of Cinemark with, it was actually this one where it's just an image of Robin Pattinson and just like a whole like copy of him like in the background.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, it's Robert Pattinson. He's been doing a good job with like Batman and a whole bunch of crazy things since Sparkly Vampire Movie.
Yeah.
And it's Bong Joon-ho. Like, I think I'm going to be there day one. That's enough. You've sold me. I don't know what I'm buying, but I want to see it now.
Yeah. Spencer got immediate buy-in right away for this one. Ames, what were some of your expectations?
Well, after seeing what Bong Joon-ho has done previously and getting...
Hold on. Pause. What have you seen previously of his work?
Snowpiercer, Parasite, and I had started The Host, but I stopped because
now, when you say started, you mean 5 minutes in and then turn around?
10.
Okay, just wanted to, okay, just wanted to make
sure. But it was, I had a meeting, so there was an actual like, not like, oh, she's scared. Like,
I think that's exactly
that's
what it
was. You were like, oh, she's scared. No, but I had a meeting. So after seeing that, and seeing not only his storytelling and his style, I was really excited. But also when I saw the trailer, I was like, oh. And after we had seen The Boy and the Heron and were pleasantly surprised by Robert Pattinson, I was like, okay, I really kind of want to see where this is going for him. So to say I was excited is a great expectation, because other than that, I don't know what was coming and I'm okay with that.
I think the biggest expectation for me was obviously with... you okay over there?
That you something on my shirt.
My bad. You're over there flicking at your shirt, and it looked like you were doing like a cut symbol. I was like, wait, what's happening here? No. Stop talking. Being a fan of Bong Joon-ho's work, like I've seen most of his films, and we were actually kind of reviewing them while we were talking on the way over here, with The Host, with Memories of a Murder, with Okja, with Parasite. Snowpiercer is one of my absolute favorite films. One of my absolute favorite non-Marvel roles for Chris Evans. Everybody should forget Red One. You know, and just seeing a lot
I
of his
did movie. For a second. I was like, what the heck is that?
My brain's like, Red? Did he mean Red? Not Red One. And I was like, oh, wait, that other one.
Right?
I don't
it's
remember.
Called Red.
Yep. Okay. I'm just, no, you're right. You're right.
You're correct.
I was
we
like,
didn't remember.
Wait, did I forget so much that I forgot the name?
Listen, you made the mistake of remembering the movie. And you brought it back
you know
up
what?
And we've both forgotten.
I have to. See, someone has to keep that, at least. I will bear that burden for you too. So you can forget, but I will bear that burden.
What?
But I've always just been a fan of the way he creates movies, especially Memories of a Murder. It is such a unique homage to like the detective noir films of like the 40s and 50s. And it's so visceral and unique in its storytelling. The Host is one of the all-time greatest sci-fi films that came out of Korea, back in the early 2000s, mid 2000s actually, and completely it blows people away as to like the nature of the film and what it kind of encompasses, as well as like the CG work that was done in it around that time. And then, like I said, Snowpiercer, absolute great film. Whoops. And then Parasite.
What's everybody and everything? Yeah.
What's there to say about Parasite outside of Academy Award winning?
Mm-hmm. Winning.
Which really.
He had the
winning.
Didn't he have the hat trick? He got three.
Probably.
For three for Parasite, if I remember.
What did he for what? Best Picture?
Writing, directing, and Best Picture, if I recall.
Oh, okay, cool. I haven't really followed it up. I saw part of the film he did for Netflix, Okja, but that's the one he did previous to this with Steven Yeun. But as far as expectations, like my biggest thing was, like you, Spence, I have absolutely jumped on that Robert Pattinson train. Mm. And it actually started before the Batman. It was the role he did in that very tedious but absolutely engaging, because I love long game storytelling. Mm-hmm. In Tenet. I loved him in Tenet. Do you remember?
Yeah, I remember just like what this audio mixing in this movie is very crazy.
Well, I think we saw it at the drive-in.
Yeah, we did.
So we were like, all right, well.
But it was fantastic.
It was. Amy hasn't seen it, by the way. So.
No, I haven't. By the way, I want to correct my Oscar wins for Parasite. Best International Feature, Best Picture, Best Director, and Best Original Screenplay.
Yeah, there you go. And these are Oscars?
Yes, they are Oscars.
So Robert Pattinson, I've had buy-in for Robert Pattinson since that point, but of course, not to, you know, diminish at all his incredible work in The Batman, and then his out freaking standing vocal work in The Boy and the Heron.
Surprising, just like the absolutely ridiculously surprising.
The fact that, and mind you, if you want to hear the full breakdown of what we thought about that, the fact that you could not tell that was Robert Pattinson in that voice. And then to take that voice, that vocal work he did there, and match that voice now with the face in this one. Ooh. In the trailers, that it was like, okay, all right. I had buy-in like immediately. I was excited to see what next on that sci-fi storytelling the director had for this. So we all got a chance to see the film immediately as soon as the film was done. Let's talk about first impressions, starting with Amy.
Okay, I really like this. Yeah. There's going to be people that hate this film, and I'm okay with that. But for me, first impressions, I just went, yes. Yes, thank you. And I want to talk about it.
All right, Spencer.
Oh, this is great. But I was not expecting religious company, like, yeah, merging energy in this. I was like, oh, I hate this, because I could see this happening, and it's terrible.
Yeah. Yeah, I 100% have to agree. This movie is a very unique way to tell this story, especially when we talk about, like, the whole cloning aspect within science fiction. But this movie is on a whole nother level. Mm-hmm. As far as the messaging, the social commentary, even the political commentary that it's you know, expressing, and I think it was funny. I think Amy hit it on the head when she had said before. What did you say? You said, she had mentioned as soon as the movie was done. She goes, well, we know what Bong Joon-ho thinks of the United States.
Yep.
Yeah.
So yep. I was like, yeah. So diving in, and as we stated, we're not going to give heavy spoilers away, but we are going to talk about aspects of the film.
I'm going to try my best, but there are so many things I want to talk about. I'm so excited, and that's a problem. So yeah. I will try to redact, my friends. I will try not to leave.
And mind you, if you want to, you know, obviously go in with you know, untainted ears, you just can pause it here, go see the movie, or go read the book, or do either of the two. Like, both of them are really great. I started in on the book. It's well written. It's really fun. Obviously why the director chose it to adapt, but either way, pause it here, go check out the movie, come back and see us. So let's talk about the performances of the movie. So obviously I just want to highlight, without a shadow of a doubt, Robert Pattinson.
Yeah.
100% phenomenal in this role. I am just loving the trajectory this man is having with his career, with his ability, with his absolute like stretch of his acting abilities, of his you know, talents, to be able not just to, you know, exude emotion and expression in the most subtle ways that evoke the most, you know, largest reactions, but even in his ability to do what only I thought at one point in time, what's his name? The guy who played young Charles Xavier. James McAvoy.
James McAvoy, yeah.
Only what I had thought James McAvoy, who had done the work in Split, mm-hmm. I thought no one could top him in creating like that multiple personality kind of, you know, capability. Mm-hmm. Different characters played by the same person. And we're not talking about you, Eddie Murphy. You know, you can keep your Hercules and all sorts of stuff. But the fact is like Robert Pattinson really put in the work and created these subtle differences within each and every clone. And when we get to the point where we have two very interesting, you know, versions, they are still the same face, but two very different personalities. Mm-hmm. And the work that he puts into each one of those absolutely, like, just blew me away. Mm-hmm. Like, what do you guys say?
Like, honestly, once you start getting deeper into the movie, I'm like, man, it's kind of a shame we didn't spend more time with any of the other Mickeys. Mm-hmm. Because like he's doing such interesting things with like these two main ones that were with for most of the movie. I'm like, what was Mickey Six like? Because he could have been like just an idiot. Like it would have been more interesting to see like more version of him. But like I like what we got though.
And I feel like there's room here to explore as well. Like we know the way the story began, and we know the way for this particular novel. We know the way the story began. And then we know at the very far end where that story ends. Between Mickey 1 and then Mickey 17, there's about, you know, 15 in between of clones and storytelling that we could absolutely kind of see and build. And I feel like that kind of lends itself, kind of like with what they did with Snowpiercer, it could lend itself to the opportunity to build out that story a little bit more and create a series or something. Mm-hmm. One of the biggest issues I feel for a lot of people that they're having is like, oh, you know, there's so many clones and there's just a lot of story, blah, blah, blah. And they're like, oh, they should have just kept it minimal because blah, blah. No. This is long game planning. Like the director knows what he's doing. Don't discount, you know, his ability. He is planting the seeds for like Netflix to say, well, what about Mickey 2 through 15 or 16? Like, what about, like, because then we start creating opportunities to see that built out. And then, obviously, like I said, the sequel's already done. But enough about the director. I feel like Robert Pattinson is continuously raising the bar for his own expectations for many people who were, and I'll be the first one to say, I was highly skeptical. I can talk. Mm-hmm. I was highly skeptical of his ability and his, you know, acting prowess. Mainly because he cut his teeth on the Twilight franchise. And I think that absolutely, what are you raising your nose for? We're not talking about Harry Potter.
That was...
He appeared in one story and he died.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was also in a deleted scene in 2004's Vanity Fair, where he played the grown-up version of Becky Sharp, a.k.a. Reese Witherspoon's kid. But that's only on the DVD. So
for what?
Vanity Fair.
Who watched... Like, who...
Hi.
That's one person. Anyway, the fact is like... His minor supporting role in Harry Potter is meh, but his main starring role where he got the most exposure is the Twilight franchise. I'd say we could all agree on that, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's no doubt on that, Amy.
I'm not doubting it.
You're not saying it. This is not a video podcast.
Thankfully, then everyone would see that I don't have my hair done. I don't know.
Anyway, the fact is like, I feel like because of that, it immediately created like this rift for like people who would give him a chance and see what else he could do versus the people who were just like, you know what? I don't ever really want to see him again. And unfortunately, because of the really weird fan base that franchise has
to this day,
like that Twilight franchise, older women fawning over like young boys and whatnot. It's really kind of scary. But truth be told, like, that put a really sour note in my, you know, ledger for Robert Pattinson. So Thankfully he started doing things that were a little bit more better. So,
and the thing is that because he intentionally, and this is something like even in the commentary, I had heard tells and whispers of the commentary track for Twilight where he just hated everything that they made him do. And he was like,
I believe it.
Yeah, because it was work. It like not that it was like, oh, hard work. It was work that he wasn't particularly proud of. He did it, but he was continually moving on to other projects. And it essentially was much like Daniel Radcliffe with Harry Potter. It's like, you're just Harry Potter. He's like, you're
but
just
Harry Potter
the Cullen
was good.
but that's the thing. When you look at the people that were coming out of those big fandom franchises, they got pigeonholed a lot because people only wanted to see the version that they had grown accustomed to. Yeah. And in relation to Robert Pattinson's, like, public love life, and then him just working through other films and filming, everyone expected him to just be the guy that was like stare pensively into the camera and be like, I'm a vampire.
Is that really what they sounded like in the movie? I'm a vampire.
Listen, I was there for the Twilight phase. I pitched my camp over in the Hunger Games team. The Twilight homies are just there. Also, it makes me feel better because he's the same age as me, so I don't feel as bad being like, yay, Robert Pattinson.
I was like, oh, I didn't realize he was slightly like a few months older than me.
Yeah, so it doesn't make me feel bad being like, good job, bud. The thing is that the expectation of the fandom that just keeps going has created it and essentially put him in such a place that we have that expectation of like the first taste. Like when we talked about in the previous episode, you talked about Joaquin Phoenix and the first time you saw him was Gladiator. And you're like, I hate him. I hate him forever. That was the same thing with Robert Pattinson, where the first thing a lot of people saw him in, which when he was Cedric Diggory, we're like, hey, okay, maybe there's something here, but there wasn't enough to actually kind of feed you. And then you get the first big one and you're like, oh God, I don't know if I like this.
Yeah.
This is a complete departure.
Oh, 100%.
This is such a delight. I don't think any of us can speak more highly to not only the physicality, but the commitment, the care, and the full like gumption that he jumped into this role with and in every iteration. And I know you talked about, well, we could definitely go like a Mickey 1 through 16. I feel, and if we're kind of talking a little, going to deviate tiny into story and then go back to acting, that the punctuating moments that you see how the other Mickeys go are on purpose, because if we dwell too long, then the catalyst that we get to in this movie with Mickey 17 wouldn't carry as much impact as it does. But Robin Pattinson, oh my Lord, like,
yeah,
all over the, and I thought of James McAvoy too, with the physicality, the movement, the way that he interacted, even when we're assuming there's a stand-in or a double when he has to and it's not just him, even him interacting there, it was so organic and it made me forget that there might be somebody else standing there versus it's just him talking to him. Like, so good.
Yeah. The other person I do want to talk about as far as main, unique, big character, and we're seeing him become more and more pronounced in terms of the roles he plays and the outside the box of, you know, what he's used to, where he started at versus where he's at now. Mark Ruffalo, seeing as he started out as kind of a rom-com guy.
Yeah, he did.
And is now kind of traversed into, you know, bombastic, very, you know, controversial roles. You know, even if we're looking at last year with Poor Things and his role in that film, this one he plays Kenneth Marshall, the Trump-esque, I guess, if we want to say, let's just call a spade a spade. You know, it's very much like the, you know, the Trump-esque figurehead in this particular film, in this particular dynamic. And I have to say, Mark Ruffalo, he knew what he was doing and he did it very deliberately. And it is so spot on. It is scary.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
There are so many elements to his performance that I just would love to just sit and pick at, as far as, you know what, when he did this, when he does this thing with his the right side of his mouth, you know, the way
his mouth the whole time.
Yes.
and the intentional,
the prosthetic teeth that he had.
The jut of the chin.
No. It was the top. So he had.
No, and he would also. He'd also stick out his chin just enough, and then he would make this shape with his lips. And I was like, I want to punch you. Mark Ruffalo. My, like, I named a puffer pig that I got from Disneyland after Mark Ruffalo. No joke. He can attest to this. And,
that's true.
And I'm just like, I want to punch you so hard in the face. And I was like, you're doing a great job.
Yeah. Yes. And, which goes fantastic. Back to what we were talking about last time. Like, he played a character so well that I just, as much as I love the actor, I hated the character.
Mm-hmm. I think what, if you can bring a performance that can make someone forget who you are and you're just enveloped in that character, you're doing a fantastic job. And that's what he's really doing in this movie.
100%.
I hate to say this, but knowing the way our current administration is going and the way certain preemptive measures have been taken versus the freedom of speech that this country has, and you know the steps that certain people have made because of people being outspoken. I feel like at a certain point in time, this is going, and this is just my own opinion. This is not the opinion of the show, but I feel like this movie could easily get banned.
100%.
Or even like spoken out against by said administration. And the fact is like, if you're jaded enough to feel like you have to speak on it, that speaks more towards your guiltiness or your mindset of guilt than it does the director's ability to just bring about an allegory of oppression and, you know, difficult leaders. Like, you know, so I have to say, like, I let it be said here that everything that Mark Ruffalo did, phenomenal job. And the character he created is pretty spot on. So,
yeah, I think, and to piggyback on that, and then I'll throw in another one that I'd love to talk about. Mark Ruffalo, he came from rom-coms for me, like 2004. I think the first one that I saw was View from the Top with Gwyneth Paltrow, and it was about her being a flight attendant. And then he had like a string of like Just Like Heaven, which had Reese Witherspoon in it, and then he had
13 Going on 30,
which was where he kind of really got the pickup on that one, because I was like, oh my gosh, 13 Going on 30. But I remember like he had that good guy, just genuine hearted kind of energy. And as he's grown as an actor, which he just gets more, not into just being kind hearted, he carries weight. He also comes into situations, and in his physicality, in his speech, he carries gravity. And that's something that when we look at the MCU, when we look at the Hulk, why there's such a differentiation between the Incredible Hulk and this Hulk, and not just Smart Hulk. He gives presence that makes you want to follow his Bruce Banner, but at the same time, he gives presence to who he is as Mark Ruffalo. And this was so jarring and so over the top and so on the nose that I know there are people who are going to be like, listen, he's too in my face. He's too much. I just can't do this. I can't be here. I don't like this movie because of Mark Ruffalo. That's the point. Like, that's part of that point. Like, get it. And he did an amazing job. I hated him so much that I loved him. Yes. And I think that's something great. Did you want
to
talk about
I just wanted to say that, like, sometimes the point of a movie is to be uncomfortable.
Yes.
Some people are too used to being comfortable, and I'm like, no, there's a time where movies used to make us feel uncomfortable by reflecting society. And I feel like that's coming back a lot.
It's coming back in spades, baby.
Yeah.
And then the person that I wanted to bring up, piggybacking, one Miss Toni Collette. What was she like? Ilfa. Her raw everything. I make this sauce, the nails, she carried the creepy, there is something underneath my smile and I'm in charge of everything vibe so well. Mm-hmm. And she is such a great actress as it is. This was just like, she stood toe to toe with Mark Ruffalo's Kenneth Marshall. So great. And you could tell where it was, like that energy just pivoted. It was so amazing to see them play off each other. And they both seemed like they were having fun, but her especially, where I was like, girl, you know, you being crazy.
Yes,
like,
so crazy.
Know. And then she had the fingernails, which literally now my mannerisms are like, if I had fingernails, I would be talking with them. And I was like, oh, dang, I'm doing it, aren't I?
Mm. Okay, her performance. I was hoping that she would get slapped by Nasha at some point, because I was just like, I need something bad to happen to you. Like, I need that. She was like so on point with just her being like behind her husband, but then also like kind of steering him in mm-hmm. places. I was like, oh, this is a toxic couple. Like,
yeah.
This is so bad.
Without a doubt.
100%.
And yeah, Toni Collette was absolutely wonderful. And there's been no, you know, shortage of amazing Toni Collette performances, whether if it was from Knives Out, Hereditary, you know, she's just made an absolute wonderful name in this part of her career and continues to do so. A couple of honorable mentions that we just want to highlight and throw out there, obviously Naomi Ackie, who played Nasha, wonderful actress, mm-hmm. incredible. I know Amy wants to mention one, Adam Colburn. He was the deck, I guess, worker, or one of the people who was
like the deck manager. But the reason, if you're ridiculous like me and you recognize him under his hat, he was one of the guys in Ted Lasso who was like one of the big sports fans that I don't even think he ended up with a name in Ted Lasso, but he's through the entire thing and his accent is so ridiculous. Yes.
Yeah. Patsy Farron, who played Dorothy, the only scientist who genuinely cared about Mickey throughout the entire film, and like just following that storyline. Steven Yeun really is making a stronger name for himself. He's come a long way from Glenn.
Yeah.
100%.
And I have to say, like, the fact that every single role that he's taken just highlights more and more of the maturity of his acting prowess. I am all for it. And yeah, it seems like every time he continues to take on roles, they just become more and more substantially unique versus like that kind of one lane, you know, bat bashing in the head kind of trajectory. But the fact that he's done some great stuff between with directors like Bong Joon-ho and Okja, as we mentioned, he did, you know, the Jordan Peele's Nope. He was in that one.
Oh my gosh, that was another one. Minari too.
Minari is another one by Lee Isaac Chung. I mean, and then obviously his run on Invincible. Mm-hmm. That's been an absolute joy to watch as well. I mean, he has just continued. Oh, the one he did with Ali Wong, Beef, the Netflix one,
where they won a whole bunch of like daytime Emmys, and I think he had a Golden Globe for that too.
More than likely. He's been killing it. And I got to give credit where credit is due. The man is making a name for himself outside of the impact that he made in the nerd community with The Walking Dead. So the fact that he's continuing to do so. Oh, even his role actually all three of us have now seen it in Sorry to Bother You.
Yeah.
You know.
Squeeze.
But moving forward, obviously, this story is one that's fairly unique and definitely is one that I think really people are going to be healthily surprised about. Like, it's not going to be something like, oh, it's just like this. Okay, blah, blah, blah. Like, no, there is a genuine, you know, world building kind of, you know, universe that we have here. And it's very unique. Although I do have to say, like, the fact that we are traversing into the conversations of cloning again, which I don't think we've had a cloning conversation in a while.
No, it's been it. I can only think of it being in the late 90s, early 2000s. So we're easily more than a decade.
Yeah.
And that's me being prudent to say a decade, because it's probably closer to a decade and a half to two. But again, it has not been at the forefront of a lot of people's minds in any regard,
or at the forefront of any kind of like media, yeah. Like storytelling media. So this one's really fun. It is a very unique universe that it builds out from the get-go, and you are really launched into something fairly unique, fairly wonderful. As you know, the story starts out obviously as like a very fun kind of like, oh, I owe you, I'm going to run away kind of thing. And it's very fun. You'll find it very interesting. That builds out the foundation for the story, but the plot device of making Robert Pattinson's character, Mickey Barnes, a quote unquote expendable, employee is very, it's a very fun, premise. I really thought that was a fun way to incorporate. How would you introduce cloning into a storyline without being too on the nose? Like, oh, we're just going to make multiples of you so you could do the work, blah, blah, blah. It's like, okay, no. The idea is you're an expendable asset, which means we don't lose you, we just remake you. Mm-hmm. And in a world of 3D printers nowadays doing probably absolutely everything out there under the sun, from making, you know, resin statues to now creating food and building houses.
And, like, and hearts or valves for hearts. There's a whole bunch of medical things that are 3D printers are being used for as well. Like, this is one of those things where it goes, you're like, oh yeah, we're doing stuff kind of like that, but not to this extreme with one whole person. Like,
nope. I think the closest we are right now is those woolly mice that everyone's talking about.
Oh, the woolly. That gives me a question about, you know, inhabitants on planets and things. Oh my goodness.
What were you guys' thoughts as far as the, and I don't know, because I haven't gotten that far in the book, but what were you guys' thoughts on the usage of the Mark Ruffalo's character kind of coming into power on the ship? The whole nature of it being like, oh, he didn't win the elections, but multiple elections apparently, and ultimately had some kind of power to create a scientific voyage to utilize.
So do you want to this one first?
Go ahead.
So there's a couple things we need to establish when we talk about this.
Okay.
One, there were already worlds that were inhabited. When Mickey signs up to be an expendable, he kind of does the little bit of this backstory to let you know that this is the last ship of the season, and it is a privately owned by him and the company, and nobody can see my air quotes except these guys. By the
that's
company.
Why I usually say quote unquote.
Yeah, that's you, not me. but the essentially, this is the Mark Ruffalo's Kenneth Marshall. It's not Mark Ruffalo. It's Kenneth Marshall. Mm-hmm. Mark Ruffalo. You live in a happy place right now. Kenneth Marshall has failed so much. He's backed by some type of big corporation money with very direct and driven religious as well as social designs, and they're sending them off into space. So, i.e., he's just a dumb charismatic figurehead that people can push around
who
they want.
Who also has a plethora of followers who happen to wear red hats and
one and only.
And they blindly and with whole hearts follow this particular individual as if he was a religious figurehead.
Yeah, yep. As if he had some type of godhood.
Even though he was just in politics.
Yeah. And he failed.
Yeah.
Multiple times. That was the kicker. The multiple times failed. And then the fact that there are people that are clamoring to be a part of this journey that are red hats. And Mickey's just like, I'll just take whatever job I can to get off world. Like, Mickey is essentially like, he has no skin in the game except his own. There's nothing for him to lose, which makes him such a great and unique point of view to kind of see not only this world and experience it, because he's not in the zealot camp. He's not in the, like, he's not fully in the save humanity camp. Like, he's just kind of there, which gives him this great ambiguity that we see played through some of the other Mickeys. And then when we get to start experiencing Mickey 17, we see where different, like, the experiences of being an expendable have kind of transformed Mickey's, mm-hmm. Mickey 17's point of view.
Yeah. And I feel like that's kind of important to establish, especially within the confines of how we've established where this story begins, in that Mickey has no desire or even knowledge of wanting to be a part of that movement, I guess is the best way to put it, while on the ship. And in fact, it's his almost disgust with it, as it is blatant throughout the whole ship, that there are mass amounts of people who are into that, 100%. That causes him to meet his love interest in the film, Asha, that we meet, who is a security agent or
yeah, she's called a security agent, but she's the police, the firefighter, and what else is she?
I know. She had like a lot of responsibilities. It was confusing.
100%.
When it comes to the storyline that we get, the majority of it is narrated by Mickey throughout the course of it. And it's kind of just bullet pointed as far as his understanding of where things are going, what is happening, who he's meeting, you know, and kind of how it progresses that way. Do you know how long the movie was?
2 hours, 17 minutes.
Yeah, I was going to say 2:14. So I'm sorry, I'm off by 3 minutes.
So 2 hours, 17 minutes. Okay, so that sounds about right. I mean, the movie does create enough opportunities for us to follow the story, and it doesn't ever feel just like rushed through. Yeah. But at the same time, it doesn't also give extensive information in like in each clone's like reasoning for like how they perished or whatever. But it is talked about, and the understanding that Mickey has throughout that journey himself, and seeing kind of his expendability and kind of not recognizing what he fully signed up for.
Well, that was, I think, part of the joke too, is that they keep asking him at the beginning, did you read the fine print? Did you read the fine print? And it's like, he's like, yeah, no, I did. And all of us are like, this is Willy Wonka all over again, my dude.
No, see, but this is worse though, because like you already know that this is a dystopian corporation. And when they're asking, did you read the fine print? You're like, oh, that's bad all around.
Yeah.
There's nothing good here.
I mean, and then when we get to, you find out the reason that Mickey is, one, a clone, and two, this is only, as an expendable, is only happening in space, is because Kenneth Marshall and his homies that want to use an expendable have been kicked off the planet by everybody else. And they're like, listen, you want to do this? You cannot be here.
Well,
you got to be away.
The cloning process in itself is banned on Earth, and that he, you know, posits to the council or whomever that they can do a clinical scientific travel as they go on their journey with this process. And
but there can only be quote unquote one.
Yeah,
there can only be one. Is literally the only person that signed up for this job, and he's going off world, and he's repeatedly dying. Like, my soul.
I do have to admit, like moving towards like the visuals of this film, there were a lot of really great, like I love this, the ship design. It's very kind of, you know, utilitarian. Like it's very functional. It doesn't look like a space, like spaceship. It looks almost like a dump truck moving through.
You mean a little alien-esque?
Yeah.
It's the funny thing is the alien, the Nostromo, has a even kinder and gentler feel to it versus this one.
Yeah.
It's not in Battlestar Galactica area. It's definitely not in Star Trek area.
No.
And it teeters between Alien, which still has like this kind of, even the later Alien movies that we've seen, this still feels like it's almost a prison.
Yeah, it looks like it's more built for functionality than aesthetics. Like it looks like when they designed it, they weren't like, okay, we're going to go ham with the Greeblies. We're going to be adding all these different elements to the design of it. And we're going to put a little C-3PO on this. Like that wasn't the functionality. That wasn't the drive behind creating this. They looked at a purpose like, we need to bus people from Earth all the way to this other side of the galaxy.
Yeah.
What does a space bus look like?
Yeah, and space Greyhound.
Yeah, it's ultimately just space Greyhound.
What does the non-first class look like?
Yeah.
That was the other kicker. Yeah.
Which you absolutely get like the callback like aesthetic to Snowpiercer immediately.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Like when it comes to where everyone else is at and even kind of on the lesser areas of the ship, even the more grungy parts, especially where the dump, like the garbage chute is at and everything, it very much feels like it's from that Snowpiercer aesthetic. So
yeah.
But as far as like once we get to the planet, once we start seeing, you know, some of the things that we get, well, even before that, like just the visuals in space are great. The CG work is absolutely wonderful. There are a lot of very fun choices when it comes to the cinematography,
yeah.
The angles, the way certain scenes are shot, the way certain, you know, directions are taken for There's a committee on board, and the design of that room where they're in seems very claustrophobic, but it is absolutely stunning. There's a huge, I think it's one or there's two pendulums in that room.
There's one pendulum and a big clock or something up behind the person that's like the speaker. Mm. But even that feels like somebody took, like did Indiana Jones have the full electrum where he had the big kind of like in the round arena type of thing going on while he spoke? I can't remember. In the one with
talking about Raiders? Or?
Yeah, in Raiders.
No, he just had a large lecture hall.
Okay. Well, yeah. It feels like literally someone's just shrunk this down, and you can tell that this isn't the space.
Oh no,
that has the most power either. I think in utilizing the way in the design of the sets and the shots, they're specifically showing you like the mess hall feels bigger than this chamber room is for all these people with power, and you're like,
Well, it's interesting because you actually make a really good point. So the places where the disheveled community meet or a disheveled committee meet, it's very claustrophobic. It's very like, it's very cramped, and it feels like it was half of a lecture hall that was cut in half again.
100%.
Like, and like it comes to almost a narrow point at the front of it. And the color palette of it is like this deep red and almost like gold, like aesthetic to kind of mimic this, you know, better than most, but still holier than thou kind of mindset.
Which is par for course with the some of that marketing inside that gym.
Yeah. And then it's funny that you mentioned the cafeteria or mess hall, whatever, because even though it seems open, it still has a sense of like the emotional, you know, readiness of people are so on high alert that it feels like they're walking on eggshells, even as they're just traversing through it. And then it peaks at points when Kenneth Marshall shows up to talk and everyone starts going crazy, and it's like you can't stand up safely and find a way out because everybody is absolutely going nuts for this guy who was there.
Which they show you at one point when people are trying to get out of an exit, and immediately, and you think the exit should be wide enough, it looks like it is, almost nobody can get out of the exit.
Yeah.
Like you're like, oh, so there was plans just in case you need to like keep people in one section and get rid of some.
But landing on the planet, you had mentioned something about creatures or whatever. I do want to highlight, because obviously there's only so much you can get to in terms of like the ship design and whatnot. But, and even the 3D printing-esque nature of Mickey's regeneration. Which real quick, as an aside of that, the fact that they used a literal brick as part of his like mental hard drive to back him up.
I loved that. That was so, the design of that, I was like, I could get one of these and put it on a shelf. It feels really fun.
Like, I feel like if you got that jumpsuit, you could walk around with a literal brick and cosplay Mickey 17 easily.
Yeah, pretty
like,
much.
Or even like a pair of twins could like walk around holding like the same brick and be like Mickey 17, Mickey 18 kind of thing.
That's adorable.
But I don't know if that's in the book or if that was a unique design choice by the director, but that was very, if ever there was a way to kind of diminish the importance of like memories and things that make people whole in a society that only cares about what, you know, they can gather from it and like the keeping in care of that, what better way to use imagery for that than like a brick? Like when we think bricks in terms of technology, when something is bricked, that means it's locked out, no longer functional. In fact, it's on the verge of just about getting tossed out without immediate care, rebooting, or even like actual technical expertise implemented. Something that is bricked is usually the next, it's the one step before you toss it out.
Is that correct, IT man?
That is, but it's also interesting. I did not take that away from that part.
Because like, as the like, IT person, yeah, over here.
I was like, when they showed that on that brick, I'm like, man, that thing looks solid. That's not going anywhere. Which I thought was smart because I was like, oh, you don't know what you're going to run into. You want something that can probably block out a lot of crap. There you go.
I mean, if we were looking for like EMP or like strong magnetic information, like trying to be pulled out of it or whatever, but like in that same instance, a brick is just one piece of a million others that help build things. But at the same time, in technical terms, when you brick something or when something is bricked, it is pretty much functionless.
Yeah.
Its only purpose at that point in time is to either display it if it's nostalgic or toss it out for the next one.
Yeah.
And the fact that Mickey had been, every time he dies, they toss him out for the next one, kind of goes hand in hand.
Okay, I thought it was, I guess I took it just in a different direction. I thought, like, you know, because it's a brick, you know, bricks for foundation.
Yeah.
Like, he's going to be the first thing that they toss out at things because, like, you know, they've got more bricks. They've got more Mickeys. They don't care.
True. Possibly.
I like yours better than this.
So, moving to the actual planet,
yeah.
The fact that the creature design that we see are essentially human-sized roly-polies.
They're mm-hmm. ohms. So if you've seen, and that was the thing I got excited about, I told him when I saw them, like, oh, they look like the ohm from Nausicaa, the Valley of the Wind. I'm so excited because they look like giant roly-polies. And they even had like little like things on their face that are look like they might be hands, might not be hands, might be tentacles, might not be tentacles. And then they were woolly when they got bigger. And I'm like, get it, woolly friends. You roll wherever you need to. Their design was so clean and it felt so tangible. I was like, are you certain you're CGI, little roly-poly friend? Like, will you hurt me?
Like, no, they're a good design because, like they did feel like they could be a thing somewhere, you know?
Right.
Unlike other objects where you're like, oh, that looks cool, but it's fake.
Yeah. That eyes looks cool, but nah, it's not real.
I really liked even the, I guess, the mama. I think it is, like, the mom.
She could be the prime, but we call it a mama.
Well, yeah. Actually, you know, that's a great use of terms. Like, we'll call it the prime. The prime creature that...
Yeah, they call them creepers, right? Yeah. But that's not their name.
No.
No, that and actually, that's what's in the book. They call them creepers in the book as well. So,
Okay, prime mama.
Prime mama prime creeper,
mama.
Yeah.
Prime mama.
The design on it is so unique and so fun. It's like a woolly mammoth meets a roly-poly, and it's absolutely, like, even everything from the details of the eyes to the underside of these creatures, and when you see them when they stand on their, I guess, whatever you want to call their hind legs, like, you see the underside of that, and the detail on all that was so just cool. Phenomenal. But actually, and I almost forgot, and I made a mental note that I really wanted to talk about it. Amy actually found a really fun Easter egg that is similar, actually, in the as far as the naming concept. It's the same name in the book as they have in the movie. So, mm-hmm. but the name that Amy found for the planet has unique connotations to it.
Yeah. So in Norse mythology, there are 9 worlds, yeah. Right? There's Isengard, and where Earth has always been Midgard. So even if you're MCU, you know where Midgard is, baby.
Yeah.
Well, so. Niflheim is the second to last planet in this lineup. The last one, I believe, is Helheim. Hell. Huh.
Yeah.
And it's a differentiation between the people that live in Helheim is fire, brimstone, that whole jam. Niflheim is misty, dark, ice, death, snowy, and it's ruled over by Hel, or Hela, as we know her in the MCU. And the whole concept is, like, this is the place people go because they died of illness or old age. Like, this is where you come to freeze your butt off. And I'm like, how poignant that these guys have sent everybody from, you know, Midgard, from Earth, to a random everybody's gonna die and an icy sickness, illness, cube out in space. How poetic.
Yeah. And it's
good fun. Job, Norse mythology. Get it.
And and yeah, the planet is named thusly. I don't know if you mentioned that the fact that the planet is named that as
oh,
well.
Oh yeah, the planet is named Niflheim.
Yeah. The planet that they're heading to, which they all state aptly, and even Kenneth Marshall says
it. He proclaims it so happily, and then he sings his questionable hymn/whatever chanty chant, like, oh, no deity could save this Kenneth Marshall from anything.
Yeah, like, when I think, like, I knew they were in bad states, like, earlier. But when we got to the part where the talk show happened, I was like, oh, they're all gonna die.
Well, and the thing is, you have to think about it because we see it, we're towards the third act or the start of the third act, and there's a talk show that's been going on, and it says, like, late night with Kenneth Marshall. So you know, every day, this fool has been putting on some type of a talk show for the last 4+ years while they're traveling in space. And people keep showing up for this trash. Yeah. And then it's broadcast everywhere. And you're just like, why? Yeah.
Another fun thing that I kind of want to mention that I kind of want to piggyback on what you had mentioned about the name. Mm-hmm. The fact that that is at the point where they get to that planet, that's when Mickey starts becoming more and more pronounced of recognizing that ultimately his life is being punished. Like he's being punished almost like in his own personal hell because of the fact that he dies and has to suffer death and then be recreated and then suffer it again. And I find it kind of unique that that's kind of what they're alluding to when they talk about Niflheim and the recognition of like my life is just complete and utter punishment.
Yeah.
Constantly. So, but yeah, I wanted to make sure we mentioned that as well.
Yeah, because the people that also went there. So there is in Norse mythology, and this is my blanket understanding of it. I have friends who can definitely go deeper than me. I would love to get their brain and I'll probably pick it later. But you know, you would go to Helheim if it was like dishonor in battle. You know, like victory in battle means you go to Valhalla. You know, that's yay, good things. Yeah. Niflheim is literally like you didn't do anything heroic, but you got sick or you got old and you just lived a meh life. You'd end up on Niflheim.
Yeah.
And then I'm just like, well, that still sucks. Yeah. You're just going to be cold.
Yeah. Obviously, we get because it's in the trailer, so we can mention it. There is a situation that occurs where a duplication occurs where Mickey is no longer one, but two current existing Mickeys within the world. And that does begin, a stream of issues that occur after the fact. And I don't want to get into it because I really want people to go and see this movie, but
100%.
That part of the film kind of kicks things off. And the fact that we get two Robert Pattinsons in pretty much most of those scenes, and they are very different performances than each other.
Wildly different. Yeah. And I think that just emphasizes when you get flashbacks to where you start thinking about the other Mickeys, you're like, oh my gosh, somewhere, you know, Bong Joon-ho has like video footage of all of those other Mickeys doing things. And I'm like, oh, you got treats, sir. You've got treats for deleted scenes on DVD.
I have no doubt that's going to be one of the extra features on like the digital download or the 4K download or whatever of, you know, all the Mickey profiles kind of thing. That'd be really fun.
That would be great. That's a good one.
So check out the film. We're kind of going to lead this conversation towards like highlights and issues. And I want to start with Amy.
Okay. Highlight for me, which we've already kind of hit on, has been I Mama Prime, Creeper, the Creepers as a whole, when you get a chance to see them up close, they are so lovingly designed. Again, this is another person that cares about their creatures and their creature design. And it translates in such a great way that I didn't think I was going to fall in love with them as much as I did. Yeah. And then also when I had that parallel of me being like, it's the Ohm. And the Ohm looks so crazy and scary in Nausicaä. And that was I think that was my third Ghibli that I saw. I was like, oh my gosh, these guys look so crazy. They look so weird. And then you finally understand who the Ohm are and what they represent and all that they're trying to do. I had that instant like, okay, I just want to pick one up and cuddle it. Like Dorothy, I just want to be a good science helper, pick them up and just take them with me. Whoop.
What the?
I almost knocked over my microphone. Spencer, I'm going to pass to you before I go for another one.
Okay, so I'm going to tread lightly here because I know we're not talking about everything. But we did mention that there's two Mickeys at one point and that they're very different. And one of the Mickeys brings up a past event and then the other one gets annoyed. He's like, why are you still talking about this? And I was like, this is such an interesting like dichotomy that they've got going on here where one is just like, you know, very logical about like, it's not your phone. And then the other one's like, you know, the pain and suffering stuff. And I'm like, I like this like impression that the movie is like basically giving us like, you know, you are who you are, but like that could be sorted into like different versions of you, you know, type thing. And I was like, that's really an interesting concept to just explore.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One of the highlights, and I kind of want to just piggyback real quick before I go into more of mine, but like the design of the creatures in this film are by far some of the best that we've seen as far as giving unique personalities to these characters, to these creatures, even in the makeup of the tiny baby ones who still, although they may look all the same, they each have a very unique personality. It's almost as if kind of like when you saw the wild robot and the little possum babies.
Meningitis takes a long time.
Each one of these little babies had personality and they had character and it showed in how they portrayed themselves. And it's funny because when you think creature design, you think Okja, you think, you know, this movie, you think The Host, you know, even in The Host where the creatures have for this director, Bong Joon-ho's ability of storytelling, they have meaning and they have symbolism. And I love how if you go back to 2006, The Host, the creature in that movie, the monster, really meant a lot to the symbolism behind the film itself, in that when he created this film, like it ultimately stood for the treatment and the trauma that his people had, the South Korean people had faced, and like even the Western imperialism that invaded into South Korea and into his people's lives over the historical time frame of the last few decades, and recognizing, like, if you look at the creatures here, it's almost like of a mindset of like the Native American people who are being invaded upon unknowingly by, you know, European white people who are coming into this unknown land and choosing to, you know, unbeknownst to them, choosing to want to take over without properly sharing or without even properly, you know, introducing or engaging with these people in a peaceful manner. Mm-hmm. Which at the time, like, all these creatures know is peace. They don't know how to be at war with something else. Yep. And it's almost like the invasion and trauma that this country has gone through at its inception, you know, by invaders from a foreign land, you know, and I love how that portrayal and that persona is just built upon so beautifully. And even in the way certain conversations occur and you come to find out, like, just the pain and the hurt they're feeling because of the actions that these people are doing. And it's almost like, as an American, you know, you see that as a Latin, you know, Latino American, as a African American over here, as a Jewish American over there, you know, recognizing, like, you know, what historically our culture, our, you know, our traditions, our people have faced due to an unforeseen group of people choosing to enforce their will upon them, you know, and I love that. I love his ability. I love Bong Joon-ho's ability to create that. Now, I did have a little bit of an issue. I know without a shadow of a doubt that the Mickeys from like Mickey 2 to Mickey 16 they probably had a great personality, probably had a great character. And I'm hoping that's something they explore more of. I really wish that there was more of an exploration, just due to the time, obviously, and the restraints of it being a movie, of the dynamic with Mickey 17 and 18. Mm-hmm. You know, I feel like Mickey 18 was a very strong personality, and the being ultimately on the other side of that spectrum to where Mickey 17 was at, and creating that unique dichotomy of personalities, I wish I had more.
Yeah,
I wish there was more of a structure to create openness for that, the way this movie goes, to just continue building on that as far as like film wise for this story. Cause I feel like this story kind of encompasses that full first book. But I'm not too sure as well, cause I haven't finished the first book. So, so here's to hoping, like, I would hope that there's more to this tale. There's more to this journey that we're going to engage upon. But even at this point, I don't think Bong Joon-ho has ever done a sequel.
Now that I think about it.
Yeah. So it's one of those things where it does kind of concern me, but at the same time, like I don't want it. I also don't want it to take away from my joy of, you know, what this movie has created. So,
yeah, you know, like, even if it ends up being a standalone film, still fantastic standalone film.
Yeah, without a doubt. Without a doubt.
100%. One other thing that I kind of wanted to touch on, which I find is funny, and I don't know if it was in the book first. Mickey's last name is Mickey Barnes,
mm-hmm.
Which is even funnier because Robert Pattinson is from the Barnes district in London. And I thought that was kind of entertaining and funny.
So the character's name in the book is Mickey Barnes.
So in other words, it's just a whole bunch of Barnes.
It's just a coinkydink.
It's all them Barnes.
Yeah. But wrapping this thing up, let's go ahead and go around the table and talk about whether or not the film passes or fails and how many monocles. Let's start with Amy.
So this film does pass for me. Pardon me on that one. I almost went film. It does pass for me. There is a artistry and an earnesty. Again, when we talk, for some reason, it seems as of late that I am coming to find that these filmmakers are coming to projects with more earnesty and their cast are coming with more vulnerability to not only express the projects that they're working on, but create great storytelling and give you opportunities to experience new things. When it comes to this film in particular, it is going to rub people the wrong way. And I love that. Mm-hmm. I love that they'll sit there and when the mirror is held up in front of their faces, they're going to be upset because they feel they're being made fun of. And the fact is, you're being called out. That's it. You call a spade. And if you recognize yourself on the screen and you get hurt by it, maybe you need to kind of look at yourself a bit. We've talked at length about the wonderful acting that Robert Pattinson has done, as well as the rest of the team in this. And it makes me not only hopeful for the future as much as that end is, but for ours as well. And the continued progression of Bong Joon-ho as a director who is defying international lines. This guy gets, you know, I'm going to give it a 4.8 because actually I kind of really want to go back and watch it one more time. So yeah, this is a 4.8 out of 5 monocles for me.
There you go, Spencer.
Okay, this movie passes for me. Let's put it this way. I've already pre-ordered the 4K Blu-ray.
Another
of this movie.
Yeah. That's 2 for 2, baby. Let's go.
When your movie can make me want to see it like again almost mm-hmm. immediately, mm-hmm. you've done something tremendously right. The cast in this movie is fantastic. There's so much that I want to talk about that we're not for spoiler reasons.
Yeah.
But like this movie is just great. It's a fun watch. And like, honestly, like when I was in that theater, I was like, you could just play this movie again and I'd sit here and watch it again.
Right?
So fun. So
Spencer's yelling at the projector, just run it again.
Doing it again. It's DJ Khaled.
We'll do it live.
Yeah, I'm going to give it a 4.5 out of 5. It's great.
There you go. As well, this story is so uniquely and unabashedly told in the most rawest ways of, you know, storytelling in sci-fi. And I feel like, as Amy so aptly put, if you are feeling any sort of way because of what the story is saying, then that speaks more towards the character of who you are rather than the characters in this film and the director and filmmakers that supported it being released. This is an absolute wonderful breath of fresh air within the sci-fi genre. And I feel like this needed to occur as far as like our ability to create more and more unique stories. We are in an age where sequels and remakes and, you know, live action adaptations are just becoming the norm. And it's sad because we shouldn't have to, you know, come to the movie theaters and only be excited because one unique story is being told as far as like amongst like 15 others who are, you know, just remakes, continuations, sequels, whatever. We should demand of our like filmmakers and of the people who are creating this content, especially with our money, that we want more original storytelling. We want more original works. We want to see something that really does break the mold in terms of what we've come to see and expect within our, you know, within our cinemas. And not just that, but even see storytelling that pushes the narrative for change, pushes the opportunity to see people held accountable. If we can't say it in the public eye, then let's say it on the silver screen. Let's say it on the television. Let's say it on the streaming channels that, you know what, change is a good thing. And if you feel you have an affront to change or you can't handle it, then you're probably in the wrong space to be even watching any of this.
100%.
So As far as monocles are concerned, I'm going to give this a 4.5 out of 5 as well. I really enjoyed it. I feel like Mickey 17 is an absolute wonderful film that people will love. And if you are definitely of the mindset that, you know what, you are open to great and new stories being told, go see this film. So, but that about wraps up another awesome episode of the Film Philosophers. Remember, you can check us out over at our website at filmphilosopherspodcast.com. There we got allegedly over 300 episodes, everything from action, anime, comedy, suspense, thrills and chills, sci-fi, and whatnot. If you're looking for it, head on over to our website at filmphilosopherspodcast.com. You can also check us out wherever podcasters streaming, and that's iTunes, Libsyn, Player FM, Audio Boom, Spotify, Pandora, TuneIn, iHeart, Amazon Music. Tune into your heart's desire on any one of those platforms. Look for us there at The Film Philosophers. Give us a follow or subscribe and listen in. Tell us what you think. Did you see the movie? Did you like it? Did you not like it? Are you one of those people who got offended by it? Let me know. I want to hear your thoughts because I want to know where your headspace is at. And yeah, we'd love to hear your thoughts. So yeah, drop us a line in the comment section down below. And if you like what you hear, give us a 5-star review because we've earned it.
We have.
Yes, please.
You can also check us out over at the socials at facebook.com/philosophers and on Twitter, Instagram, and Threads at filmphilosophy101. You can also check us out at Blue Sky at Filmphilosophers Podcast. Over at Instagram, that's where we post also some of our extra content, such as Spencer's Big Score and Amy's Jane on Scene, which can be found where?
The only place it's ever lived, which is at Jane on Scene on Instagram and Instagram only. And I swear, even though it's not updated, I have been seeing new things, not just new releases. But yeah, yeah, you want sure. to go okay. find it. You don't believe me. Fine. Whatever.
I'm still waiting for Steel Magnolias. But
you keep bringing that up. And what is it that you're like trying to make Fetch happen? It's never going to happen.
This is you trying to make Fetch even be talked about. Anyway.
What?
Well, this is a great show and this is a great conversation. So we thank you for joining us and we had fun. So until next time, I'm Eddie.
I'm Spence.
I'm Amy. I'm going for a new position here, people.
Class dismissed.
Promotion?
Ready to roll? Don't everybody talk all at once.
I'm a professional stone turner. Yeah.